And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Usry, and I'm happy to welcome Preston Lauterbach to the program today. Preston is an author of nonfiction who has concentrated on the African-American experience of the American South, and Memphis in particular. His first book was The Chitlin' Circuit and the Road to Rock and Roll, about musical venues and musicians in the South and neighboring states, serving a black clientele with good times and better music. His second book was Beale Street Dynasty, which looked at the early and prime days of the capital of black America in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. Today we'll be talking about his latest book, Bluff City, The Secret Life of Photographer Ernest Withers, the man responsible for many of the greatest photos of the Civil Rights era, and how his legacy has come into question since it was revealed that he was an informant for the FBI. So, Preston, at the beginning of the book, you describe a visit you had with Mr. Withers. What was the purpose of that visit?
You know, at the time I met Mr. Withers, I had just moved to Memphis and was impressed at the number of fantastic individuals who were just around and available, whether it be Al Green preaching in the church or Isaac Hayes bumping around town or Willie Mitchell's Rolls Royce rolling up Poplar Avenue. And Withers, to me, was already a legend when I got here. And so to see him working events, you know, in nightclubs and taking pictures was quite remarkable to me. So he was perfectly accessible and approachable, for one. But the thing that really pulled me in to Memphis and made me a writer was researching Beale Street culture and history. And so all three of my books start there. And having a chance to meet him was just an opportunity to delve into that culture and that history with somebody who was there and made, you know, the most vivid documents of the nightclubs, the churches, the atmosphere, the street itself. I mean, his work really does capture it so perfectly. And so I had to introduce myself and ask if he'd put up with me for a little while.
Do you think your status as kind of an outsider, even from town, helped you out a little bit in those investigations?
Always found it beneficial to not be from Memphis as a white person researching black culture for the most part. And I don't know exactly what else to say about that, because it's not really, you know, my perception that's more welcoming of the outsider. It'd be interesting to talk to people who I've interviewed and say, well, why did you trust this guy? But I have noticed it as a trend. I think that black people in Memphis, there is probably a sense of lack of appreciation, particularly among musicians, because there's Elvis, there's Johnny Cash, there's Jerry Lee, there's Sun Records, there's Graceland. I mean, that's the mecca of Memphis, is that whole orbit of white artists. And the black artists are the one who came up with everything. They're the originators. I mean, we could go down the line. And so I think that there's a sense, and this, I'm just totally guessing. This is going way deeper than anybody has ever gone with me on the subject. But, you know, if I was in their shoes and I knew that I was the originator, I'd be a little pissy about it, I suspect.
But Ernest Withers himself kind of had a positive view of Elvis. He didn't seem to hold a grudge against Presley.
Oh, not at all. Not at all. In fact, Withers took some of the most important pictures of Elvis that have been taken, because there is this enduring controversy with Elvis and racism, because he performed so much black music and because he became so successful and so wealthy from a base of black music. You know, there is a sense of bitterness and a sense of ripoff with regard to Elvis vis-a-vis black artists. Elvis in the community, though, was a different story. And Withers followed Elvis around Beale Street. And he'd listen to the way that Elvis interacted with African-American people and noted that Elvis was humble, quiet, respectful, deferential. And I think if you studied Elvis, you understand that that is the case. That was very much a facet of his personality and the way that he treated other people. I mean, he always had a lot of respect for folks, especially if you consider respect in the form of buying strangers automobiles. I mean, so Withers listened to Elvis. I say that he photographed Elvis with his ears almost as much as with his camera, almost as much as he did visually, because he listened to the way that Elvis spoke to African-American people. And so when it came time to photograph Elvis, he was able to authentically capture Elvis at ease, at comfort, and in respectful, equal poses with African-American artists, whether they be B.B. King, Rufus Thomas, Carla Thomas, Bobby Blue Bland, all of the legends of Beale Street and black music in Memphis. These were all people Elvis admired, looked up to. I think he covered all of their songs, with the exception of maybe Carla. Johnny Ace was another Elvis covered. who was around in Elvis's early days. And so Withers photographed Elvis in poses that, like I say, were comfortable, at ease, that I think really signified Elvis's respect for these figures as artists and as humans. And this happened in 1956, 1957, like peak early Elvis. Don't Be Cruel, Hound Dog, Heartbreak Hotel had just hit number one. I mean, he was the most sensational white artist during this time. And at the same time, segregation was probably the top domestic issue in the news at that particular point. And it was very controversial for a white artist to be around black people, to cross the color line. This was during the time of the Montgomery bus boycott, you know, when Dr. Martin Luther King and the NAACP were battling segregation in the courts. And Elvis was able to symbolically cross that barrier and be captured on Withers' film and to make a statement that was risky at that time, because he risked alienating white fans, white business people, whether they be sponsors of radio programs, hosts of radio or TV programs. He risked alienating his business. So not only was it risky at the time, but it really endured as a comment about this controversial issue of Elvis and race. What did Elvis really think of black people? Because he did go on to become a bit aloof from African-American people, but in his early days anyway, Withers captured the real Elvis with regard to African-American music.
In that first visit with Withers, he left you alone for a little bit, expressly told you not to touch anything. And then what did you do?
I did what he told me not to do.
Why?
Got bored. He left me there for like 30 minutes.
I think that's why you're an investigative writer and I'm just a guy who asks questions.
Would you have touched?
No.
You really would not have touched?
No.
See, my rationale was that he had told me not to touch anything. I knew in my heart that I wasn't going to do anything wrong. I was just going to have a look. And he shouldn't have left me in there for so long. I mean, it was inconsiderate on his part. No, what happened was I went to meet him and, you know, I had no pretenses whatsoever. I wasn't writing for anybody. I was just doing this research. For what reason? I didn't know at the time. I said, can I come by and talk to you? Actually, I was interested in the Chitlin' Circuit. I said, I'm interested in the Chitlin' Circuit. He said, oh, okay. I think I ran into him in Schnucks and just stopped him and said, you know, I'm not worthy or whatever. He didn't care about any kind of praise or anything like that. I mean, didn't do a damn thing for him. But he said, yeah, come on down to the office. I'll talk to you, whatever. So since I had no pretense, he had a business meeting scheduled at a similar time. And so this guy comes in to talk business with Mr. Withers. And Mr. Withers led me back to this dungeon that he kept behind his office. It was really his vaults. It's where his family keeps his archive and museum today. And so I was in this room with this big glass picture window that had Ernest C. Withers Building embossed on the other side of it. And I was in there for a really long time. And I got just sort of aggravated. And I'm starting to look around. And he didn't put me in a bare or empty room. He stuck me in a room that had all of these really intriguing piles of black and white photographs. And I'm like, oh, God, I'm in the Withers vault. You know, put me somewhere where I don't want to touch anything next time. So I just kind of started going over there, you know, picking up a little pile, taking a peek at this, a peek at that. And as soon as I finally kind of got comfortable with this violation of his trust and picked up a pile of 8x10s and kind of leaned back on the shelf there, I hear the door open. And the first thing he says is, I told you not to touch anything. He was pissed, but he got over it. You know, he recovered very quickly. And what had happened, and I didn't know this until later, he had been stolen from a man who's now deceased and had made it his business to take the photographic works of African Americans in particular and to do with Southern music and copyright these things and make money off. It was a guy who copyrighted the photographs of Robert Johnson and made money off them for years. This guy went into Withers' office, asked to interview him or whatever his pretense was, and made off with several of Withers' classic photos. And Withers was down on Beale Street and saw them in postcard form and said, what the hell is going on here? And had to go through a lengthy and expensive legal proceeding to get his own photos back. So that was in the back of his mind, or probably rather the front of it, when he was sticking me in that room and telling me not to touch anything. And I'm little old me thinking, well, who am I? I'm not going to do anything wrong. I can take a peek at these. But to him, you know, I was a potential thief because it had already happened. I'll tell you this. Part of why I use that story to kick off the book is not only because it was the beginning of my Withers story, but you know, he became a controversial character himself. And so by saying that I'm marginally dishonest human being, admitting, putting my own flaws out there. I'm saying I'm not here to judge this man. You know, I understand what it's like to make shadowy decisions, to do things that that maybe not everybody would do given the circumstances. And so I wanted to put that in the front of people's minds as they read this. Is, you know, this guy's really not here to judge. He is willing to put his own flaws and his own shortcomings out there. And so therefore, hopefully we can trust him to be fair with Withers. And so it was, you know, something that to build a relationship with readers so they will understand where I'm coming from with the story. Because despite how, you know, controversial and challenging the Withers story becomes, I have nothing but sympathy for him. And I drew on that feeling of sympathy throughout the research and the writing of the book, the more challenging the story became.
So we're talking before the official publication date. Have you had any reaction from the family? Did they get early looks at the book to kind of
yes.
give their opinions of it?
Yes.
What have their reactions been?
So the leading family member now with regard to Ernest Withers' photography is Ernest's daughter, Roz. And there's a Withers family trust. I don't know exactly how that's composed and who is a part of it. But she would be the head of that trust, and she is the one who's leading the museum, their efforts at digitizing and archiving his vast body of work that he left scattered around on tables at the time of his death. And so the revelation of his work with the FBI was a total shock to her and a surprise. She didn't know anything about it, and it's been very hard for her to deal with because she knew and loved her father. She was very happy, I'm sure, with him as this hero, civil rights icon, well-known, well-regarded photographer, end of story, great life tied up in a neat little bow. Then all of a sudden, this FBI informant stuff comes out. That's about the worst stigma you can stick on a civil rights activist, a member of the African-American community whom everybody trusted. Very hard, you know, for her to deal with, and I think for people to look at in an open-minded fashion. And so, you know, from the beginning, as this book evolved, it was very important to me to be forthright with her about what I was doing, what I was finding, you know, to share with her my research, a lot of it just about his journalism career. Hey, this photograph published in the Chicago Defender in 1957, here's a slide of it. So I shared a lot of my research with her. And when it came time to publish the book, I wanted to publish his photographs. I wanted to have some of his work to include in there. That's very important. And that's her call. She asked to look at certain chapters and certain moments of the story before she would approve, you know, the official use of his photography in it. And ultimately, it passed muster with her, and I pulled no punches. I said, you know, I don't want you to feel like I've sideswiped you, and this book comes out, and then all of a sudden these other things are mentioned. And so I told her everything that I had found, anything that I found to be frightening, challenging. I shared it with her, and I explained my evidence and my analysis of it. She has been nothing but courageous, open-hearted, a friend to my work. And I can only imagine how difficult her whole journey has been because of these revelations that have come out. And, you know, I want to be very clear. It wasn't me who broke the story. I don't want to be like, yeah, this is all my stuff that I'm coming out with. You know, the reporter in Memphis, Mark Peruskia, and the Commercial Appeal came out with it almost 10 years ago. So just the revelation of Withers working with the FBI, I mean, that's old news. I wanted to look into some different questions with regard to that. And I wanted to do a little bit more with his life story than just FBI informant.
Well, and given how the publishing industry works, you're probably handing in your final edits, and then Mark Peruskia's book comes out last year about this time. That must have made you feel some way or another.
Well, I was already done. I'd gone into production. I went into production in December of 2017, and the normal turnaround cycle would be you go from production to hard copy in 9 or 10 months, which would have put me out in September or October. Hopefully this isn't talking too much shop, but, you know, that is typically blockbuster time. And since I'm not Stephen King, my publisher said, well, let's just hang on to this until January when things get a little quiet and maybe you can make some noise then. So I was done and had, you know, moved on to the next thing by the time Mark's book came out. And meanwhile, I mean, I had known that he was working on a book. We actually had a conversation at one point, which he indicated he wouldn't be helping me. I don't blame him. But, you know, as I acknowledge Mark Peruska and his reporting and the legal challenge to the FBI on the FOIA request that allowed a pretty hefty selection of Withers' FBI case files to be made public, you know, I'm indebted to that reporting and that release of information. Aside from that, you know me as somebody who's been doing Beale Street for a long time. Like I said, I was interviewing Withers about it in 2004, which was before my first book came out. And I started, well, first of all, actually when the news about Withers broke, 2010, I'd just gotten a contract to publish a massive history of Beale Street from after the Civil War to after the Civil Rights Movement. That turned into two books, one which was Beale Street Dynasty and the second which is this. And so books just – I never just come out with the book I say I'm going to come out with at the time that I get a deal from a publisher. So when this particular volume began, it was the summer of 2014. And even then, this was not going to be about Withers. It was going to be more of a Beale Street Dynasty sequel, you know, nightclubs, politics, culture, music, civil rights, journalism, all the things that were in Beale Street Dynasty was going to be here. But as you know, as you get into a story, you need to have a good character. And it's best if you can just stick to one and not veer around too far. And so as my research deepened, and look, I mean, I noticed that Withers was everywhere. He was in the nightclubs where I wanted to be. He was at the civil rights meetings, baseball games. I mean, he was at political rallies. He was everywhere that I wanted to be. Meanwhile, in his afterlife was continuing to become more and more interesting as these revelations about him, about his secret work with the FBI, kept piling up. And so this book, Bluff City, evolved about being from Beale Street during this time to being about Withers and, you know, with a nice twist of Beale Street on the side.
Well, and you do a lot of scene setting, and I was wondering at what point did you have to pull back on this description of the times as they were to concentrate more on the Withers story? Because there is a lot of scene setting here.
Right, and I would much rather live in scene setting. I mean, that's my favorite. I love that. I love going into a place and figuring out, you know, a place I've never been before, a place that was torn down before I was born, and to bring it back to life. I mean, that's my favorite thing to do. And so, you know, it's not always appropriate to go to such lengths in a book about a figure if they're not necessarily there. I mean, the shape of this book changed on numerous occasions. There are chapters that did not make the final cut, things that had to be cut in order to allow the narrative to flow properly and to make sense, to have the right kind of pace and continuity. And that's my indulgence, though, is to go off and to digress on into different places and different characters. And so as you read this book that's ostensibly about Ernest Withers, you're going to read about Calvin Newborn, you know, the guy who Elvis got his moves from, Evelyn Taylor, the first African-American realtor who helped to integrate the Glenview neighborhood of South Memphis in the 50s, and Reverend James Lawson, I mean, one of the greatest leaders, period, that this country has ever seen, who made an impact in Memphis as a local minister. And so there's Withers, and then there's his world. And I want those characters in his world, even Frank Holloman, you know, the head of the FBI and the police department. He's a character. He's a living, breathing thing in these pages. And so all of these people who are in the Withers orbit are important to his story, even if you're not reading about Withers on every single page and every single paragraph.
Let's talk more about the man himself. How did Withers become interested in photography in the first place?
The story is, I believe it was his sister bought her boyfriend a little brownie. This would be in the 30s, you know, one of those beautiful little iconic brownie cameras, little box camera, as a gift. And the boyfriend didn't want it. And so little Ernest, the fates pushing behind him with all their might, said, well, can I have it? And took it to school with him. And appearing at his school, which was Manassas in North Memphis, was Joe Louis, the world heavyweight champion's wife, Marva. And she was an attractive personality and a talented person who was putting on some kind of a program. And so young Ernest, who I believe was in his early teens at this time, brought his little brownie cam to this performance of Marva Lewis and had an experience to where he was able to block out all of the distractions going on around him, the noise going on around him, and he moved right to the front of the auditorium, even though everybody was heckling him and laughing and saying, man, get out of the way. We want to see her. He moved right in on her and took her pictures. And so he really became a photographer in a very natural way. Quickly after that, he joined the Army and became a bit of a hustler in the photographic game. And so the art of the hustle and the art of photography went together in his story pretty early on. He was taking snapshots out on an island in the Pacific that soldiers could send home to their parents, their girlfriends, or whomever to say, hey, still alive, here I am. Withers would charge him a couple of bucks for these. And he had this whole system set up where he would trade. They were actually rationed canned beers back then. They were just in olive drab cans. I don't know what brand it was, but the soldiers, they got their smokes, Lucky Strikes or whatever, and they got their six cans of beer. And so he would pull all of his beers together, his beer rations, and he'd go to the photo lab on the base and would get materials, would get paper and film and chemicals and set up a dark room in his barracks. And guys would be lined up to go get their picture taken in Ernest Withers' barracks, white soldiers, and this was a segregated base. And so the commanding officer sees all these white guys going into this African-American guy's tent and figures there's something amiss. So he says, well, Withers, what you doing in there? You running a whorehouse? And he says, no, I'm just taking these pictures and sending them back home and let the boys, let their family know they're okay. And so the commander said, oh, okay, go ahead. So he kind of blessed Withers' hustle. And that's a formative experience in his life, I think. But after he came back to Memphis after World War II, he set up a photo lab and started to work as a freelance photographer and took pictures in nightclubs, would go to the Negro League baseball games at Martin Stadium in downtown Memphis, home of the Memphis Red Sox, Negro League World Series champions of 1948, if I'm not mistaken. Take people's pictures, go to the nightclubs. He said that he would shoot them sober and sell them drunk. So he'd just show up at the beginning of the night and take everybody's picture and then run back to his lab, either his home or his lab, process the photos and take them back to the club or the baseball game toward the end of the night or the end of the game and sell them. And that's how he got started in the business. From there, he went into news photography.
Even though he wasn't really in peril while he was in the military, it did inform his sense of patriotism, and that might be one of the explanations that lead us to why he might have worked for the FBI.
Oh, yeah, and there's no question about his patriotism, and he came from a long line of military men. A grandfather was a great-grandfather, I don't have it in front of me, was a Union Army veteran. His father was a World War II veteran. Of course, he was a World War II participant. His sons would go on to join the military as well. And so that was a big part of his life for sure.
While he's taking pictures on Beale Street, he's also trying to have a regular job to have that steady income coming in. And he is one of the first African-American police officers in Memphis.
That's right. Yeah. 1948, up until that point, all white Memphis Police Department brought in its first class, I believe, of a dozen African-American officers, one of whom was Withers. And you know, he never went into a tremendous amount of detail in his interviews about how he got that job. But, you know, I don't think that you just come in off the street and fill out an application and get named one of the first African-American officers in the city. And so his father was politically connected. His father ran a voter registration and polling place in their neighborhood. Arthur Withers was his father's name. So Mr. Arthur Withers had been active in politics in Memphis throughout the years of the Crump machine. And so that would lead to, you know, his participation or cooperation would certainly lead to the sort of political connectivity that could perhaps help his son get a good job like that.
And it is strange that E.H. Crump, known as Boss Crump in Memphis, died right as the civil rights era started.
No, it's incredible. You know, the marker that I put on it is Elvis recorded That's All Right, Mama, you know, a white singer doing a black song in July of 1954. That's the period of the Brown versus Board education decision, desegregating public schools. And in, I believe it was October of that same year, Mr. Crump died. So within just a few months, earth-shaking changes to the way things had been for almost a half century in this city.
Mr. Withers started working with L. Alex Wilson of the Tri-State Defender. How did he get started with that, and what did Mr. Wilson teach him?
Wilson is one of the key figures in this story and is a man I think worthy of a biography of his own. Tremendous journalist and courageous figure. Was also a World War II veteran as a Marine who saw quite a lot of combat in the Pacific Theater. and was a journalist after that in the South, you know, during the civil rights movement. He was known to quip that he felt a lot safer at Iwo Jima, you know, than he did in Mississippi. So Wilson is this tall, thin, dapper, straight-laced, no profanity, smoking, drinking, serious man, editor, writer. And so he worked for the Chicago Defender newspaper chain. Well, that was the most powerful media outlet for African Americans during that time. And the Tri-State Defender was the Defender outpost in Memphis. So Wilson became editor there in around about 1954, as Withers was becoming one of the top freelance photographers working for the Tri-State Defender and other papers as well. You see his work published in the Pittsburgh Courier and some of the other Baltimore Afro-American and some of the other independent African-American newspapers that were published at that time. So Wilson has this real knack for being on site for the story. He used to tell his employees that when he was a teacher in Florida, a group of Ku Klux Klansmen had barged into where he was and threatened him, and he had actually run. And he felt so despondent about this that he vowed that he would never run again. And that informed his coverage of the civil rights movement. And so Wilson brought Ernest Withers along on a variety of assignments. And so all of these iconic photographs that Withers made during the mid-50s, whether it's at the Emmett Till murder trial or in Montgomery, Alabama during the Montgomery bus boycott or in Little Rock during the integration of Central High School, Withers was working there with L. Alex Wilson. And so it was really Wilson who, you know, I think is behind Withers' uncanny knack for being at the moment of breaking history repeatedly during that time.
You had mentioned his name a little bit earlier, Reverend Jim Lawson, and he was a different breed of clerical activist.
You know, he brought a certain amount of international perspective to the civil rights movement. He was from the North, from Ohio originally, and served a stint in, I believe he was incarcerated for refusing selective service in the Korean War. It's a principled stance that he took because I believe that he could have filed his draft status as a conscientious objector for religious reasons as a minister. He protested against the war, against the draft, against all of it. He refused to participate with any of it. And so instead of conscientiously objecting, you know, he went to jail. He did that when he was in his youth. I'm not sure. I think he was about 21 years old when that happened. After that, he went over to India on missionary work, and there he discovered Gandhi. And just as he's reading about Gandhi and becoming immersed in massive nonviolent resistance, civil disobedience, he reads about this minister in Alabama named Martin Luther King Jr. And as soon as Lawson returned to the United States, he hooked up with King. King, who was also philosophically connected to the teachings of Gandhi, saw a like individual. And so Lawson was an early member of King's Southern Christian Leadership Conference board. I don't know exactly what his role was, but he was certainly a partner to King in that, and Reverend Lawson helped to organize some of the earliest sit-ins in Nashville. And so his, as I said, he brought a certain international perspective, and that is that he brought this Gandhi style of resistance against the empire to the South, and he taught people, he workshopped the activists, because who knows how to be nonviolent? I mean, where does that idea as a tactic come from? And so he helped teach students and activists in that early generation of mass activism in the movement how to be nonviolent, what the tactics were and what the strategy meant. Where he was out of place was not with someone like King, but it was in Memphis, because Lawson was outspoken. He believed in as much confrontation and as much protest, as much forcing the issue as possible. You know, Memphis is a pretty laid-back town now, as it was back then. The style of civil rights advancement that had evolved in Memphis in the 50s was more of negotiation and partnership and trust between NAACP leaders like Vasco Smith, for example, and the mayor, the chief of police. And so things like school integration happened, you know, more or less, and downtown integration of movie theaters and stores. Those things happened here without as much conflict and drama as they did in other places like Nashville, like in Mississippi, like over in Alabama. In Memphis, the sense of partnership between black leadership and white leadership had gotten things to a place that was satisfying enough, I think, for NAACP leadership. Jim Lawson comes to town it's not moving fast enough. People are too laid back. People are too calm. People are too gradual in their approach to change. He believed in pushing as much change as fast as possible. And so his style was very much in conflict with the more laid back and more collaborative, cooperative style of black leaders in Memphis.
A man just as committed on the other side to confront is Mayor Loeb. And he was the wrong mayor for the time, it seems.
It's interesting. Loeb and King, though Dr. King was not really all that active in Memphis. I mean, he came through for a speech here for an event there, but he wasn't based in Memphis and he wasn't super active here. But Loeb and King actually had some pretty long history leading up to the sanitation strike in 68. That is the first time that Loeb ran for mayor in 1959. He did so against what was called the volunteer ticket, which was the largest black voting political organization to come out of Memphis in decades. Well, the volunteer ticket with King's support as a speaker and a leader, actually King came to support the volunteer ticket in 1959 and gave speeches at the Mason Temple, the Church of God in Christ headquarters, which is exactly where he gave the mountaintop speech the night before his death here. So King helped to rally a record number of African-American voters to the polls in 1959. It would have been enough to win the previous election. But all of this black political activity so incited white voters and white politicians that they too turned out in record numbers to make sure that black candidates were not elected. And the man they elected was Henry Loeb. And so this history repeated itself in the spring of 1968 when the Memphis sanitation workers went on strike. It's a longer story, I think, between King and Loeb and Memphis than you get if you just look at the strike on its own.
How did FBI agent Bill Lawrence come into Withers' orbit?
Well, Lawrence was a longtime FBI agent in the Memphis office, which is fairly rare. These guys tend to move around often annually, every couple of years at the most. He came to Memphis, I believe, in the 40s and spent, I believe, his entire career and really built a niche working in racial intelligence. So Lawrence's friends were all of the key NAACP leaders in town. And I think that's another thing that hasn't been highlighted to the extent that it should have in the whatever sense of outrage there is about Withers participating, cooperating with the FBI. All the NAACP leaders during that time shared information with Lawrence. It might have been different in nature from the way that Withers interacted with him. But simply to talk to the FBI about what was going on in civil rights was not seen as, you know, some secretive treachery back during that time. So Lawrence had a good relationship with NAACP leadership. And Lawrence went to Little Rock in 57 when Central High was integrated, really as an answer to the demands of African-American leadership for some federal attention to civil rights. Back during the Emmett Till killing in Mississippi in 1955, there was no federal response whatsoever, despite the fact that a total miscarriage of justice took place. Everybody knew it. Men who killed him admitted to the crime. Nothing happened. So that led to a real outcry among African-American leadership about the feds getting involved where states weren't going to uphold the law, right? The feds eventually came around, and Little Rock in 57 was really the first time that you saw Eisenhower call in the 101st Airborne, serious federal might to enforce integration in order to get those first nine African-American students into the high school. Withers was there, and he saw that. Agent Lawrence was in Little Rock interviewing African-American people, trying to figure out the source of the violence that took place, trying to figure out, you know, who had instigated this and what it was a part of. And so Withers saw that contrast between no federal action in the Till killing in 55 and a, you know, strong and positive federal presence in Little Rock a couple of years later. And Withers and Lawrence ended up being in several of the same places after that. There was a major case in West Tennessee involving voting rights that, once again, the FBI was involved with and ultimately, I think, helped lead to some positive advancements for the cause of African-American voting. So I know now we look at the feds and the movement in terms of J. Edgar Hoover and Dr. King and their rivalry and the letter, you know, telling King to kill himself, and the surveillance of King having extramarital affairs, and, you know, the rumors swirling around the FBI and the King assassination. In the early 60s, that type of animosity and acrimony, it wasn't, you know, totally visible. And in fact, someone in 1960 who was pro-civil rights could see at least some potential for the FBI being helpful. I'm not going to be so naive as to suggest that everybody believed that the FBI was going to ride in on white horses and fix everything. But there was at least the potential there for the feds to assist in the positive advancement of the movement. And so the face of that locally was Bill Lawrence, who was friendly with black leadership and who became Withers' handler.
Also, Withers' past indiscretions kind of made him an easier person to approach because they did have a little bit of leverage on him.
We mentioned earlier Withers' time on the police force, which ended in scandal when Withers was caught engaging in some sort of bootlegging. Now, I know from having researched a century of Memphis policing and bootlegging on Beale Street that they ran the racket and that he must have stepped outside of their rules about how to do illegal things. He wasn't cheating by their rules, and so they fired him. That's that fact. Mm-hmm. You know, the people on NPR don't want to hear that, but that's the way it was. It's not an excuse. But
he didn't pay off the right person above him, probably.
Yeah, something like that, or he was doing business with a non-sanctioned bootlegger is what I guess. That's neither here nor there. But, Withers did have a child outside of his marriage. But my understanding was that his leaving the police force and the outside child, you know, if it was a James Ellroy novel, perhaps those would be leveraged against Withers to get him to cooperate. They have their ways. In truth, I don't know that those episodes would have been all that influential to him. I look at it more as Withers is a self-confident individual. He thinks he knows the score. I think he thinks that he can help by interpreting and analyzing what's going on. He's a self-confident man. He's an intelligent man. And he does have access to privileged knowledge. And he is, as I said, a hustler from the very beginning. I mean, from, you know, selling those snapshots sub-legally on the military base, he's just always hustled. And if you spend any time in Beale Street history, you know that that's how it is. And I think if I was on, again, I told you that at the beginning how sympathetic I am to him. If I was on the wrong side of the segregated economy, I bet I'd get to be pretty resourceful too. But have to. I bet I'd take some risks. I don't think too much about Withers' indiscretions, though I discuss them in the book and they make for an interesting character. I don't know that those are powerful influences on his action of becoming an FBI operative.
Well, with his being passed away over a decade ago, I mean, how do you go back and research that and make these conclusions with some confidence?
In terms of his daughter outside the marriage, his family indicated to me that his wife knew about that when it happened. And that, in fact, he has 8 children in his marriage. And his outside child, if I may use that phrase, was a daughter. Well, he had only had sons in his marriage up until that point. And when his wife found out that he had had a daughter outside of the marriage, she said, well, you're going to give me a daughter too. Well, they kept having sons. They ended up having 7 sons just to even the score of getting Mrs. Withers a daughter. Finally, the last child was Rosalind, the daughter, and at that point they could quit. Well, that left Ernest and Dorothy Withers with 8 children.
To support,
which is another motive, I believe. But yeah, it's my understanding that the daughter from outside the marriage was a situation that everybody knew about and was dealt with in family. I had the pleasure of meeting her recently, and I asked about their relationship. I didn't get a chance to interview her for the book, but I said, well, what was your relationship like with him? And she acknowledged, she looked me right in the eye and smiled and said, well, I was not from that house, but he came over and he visited and would watch the baseball games at my house. He loved the Chicago Cubs and helped out how he could financially. And he was a presence in her life and she in his family. She wasn't a secret. In terms of bootlegging activity and that kind of hustling, it was just so typical. I don't see how the FBI could have leveraged an old bootlegging charge against him when he'd already been disciplined by the police force for it. Now, it may have indicated to them that he was indeed on the make and on the take. They knew about it. It's in his file. And it had to have gone into their assessment of him, what he would do, what he was capable of.
So at this time in the mid-60s, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee is not really thinking so much about being nonviolent anymore. And the kind of language that's being used is one of the things that Lawrence of the FBI wants to know, if that's going on in Memphis.
Black power, specifically.
Stokely Carmichael.
Absolutely, absolutely. And black power became, I think, the most important case, the most important theme in Withers' espionage. There's a group in Memphis called the Invaders. They eventually came to be known as the Invaders.
I didn't know it was a television program.
Yeah. Isn't that something else? And one of the, you know, it's a loosely knit group of guys, and they were from South Memphis, and various bands of South Memphis kids, you know, whether you want to call them gangs or fraternal organizations or buddies or whatever, they would get together and make t-shirts or jackets or whatever. And so this particular clique in South Memphis came to be called the Invaders after a TV show about, I believe it's aliens who have taken on a human form and mixed in with us in our society. And so they liked that, you know, they liked that theme and that the threatening aspect of mixing in with society at large. That was their goal. They were really just a group of poor kids, some of whom had come through Atlanta going to school. And that was the home base of Stokely Carmichael and of SNCC, as that group and that figure became the center of the black power movement. And so these guys in what came to be known as the Invaders, and it's guys like Kobe Smith, who's still alive in Memphis, Charles Cabbage, who's deceased now, John B. Smith. Kobe Smith's from North Memphis. The rest of them are from Riverside neighborhood in South Memphis. But they all got together and started protesting. And it started off, and to connect their efforts with a character we discussed earlier, Reverend James Lawson. Well, Lawson embraces them, and he sees that they have every right to be angry, and he doesn't agree with preaching violence, but he feels like the energy and the purpose and the intent are all in the right place. And so he really brings them in and wants to protect them in a way, to make sure that they don't get into too much trouble. So many other responsible adults, you know, were turning their backs on these young guys. And so Lawson wanted to take care of them. Well, that gave Withers something else to report on. And so by 1967, in the summertime, when there were riots going off throughout the country, there were the first rumors of a riot in Memphis. These riot rumors generated from the rhetoric that these young guys were putting down. I mean, they were talking about how the city should burn. And this was fairly typical rhetoric of the Stokely Carmichael philosophy and that generation. Nobody knew what to make of it. Are they serious? Are they going to do this? Can they do it? Do they have the ability? Withers was as interested in this as the FBI. Withers, you know, we touched on his military service and his NAACP membership and his participation in so many key events in the movement as it gained momentum. By the time the late 60s roll around, he's in his mid-40s. And you know how it is. When you pass the age of 40, you understand the way that the world works, and your opinion should be right by God. And you don't want to see a bunch of young people come along and destroy it with careless talk of burning the city. But he became friends with them. He befriended them. He let them hang out in his studio, and he would listen to them. Meanwhile, he would try to assess just how likely they were to act on any of their threatening language, whether they had any arms of any kind. And it just so happened that their vision and their momentum and visibility as a group increased exponentially throughout the spring, the winter and spring of 1968, in conjunction with the Memphis sanitation workers' strike.
Now, I've lived in Memphis a little over 20 years, and over the years I've heard of that fateful demonstration on March 28th, that it was the Invaders who started the trouble. And you paint a very different picture in this book.
Yeah, and if I can go a little bit longer on that particular issue, if we're there, on March the 28th of 1968, Dr. King came to Memphis to lead a march in support of the strike, which had been going on for 6 weeks up until that point. The sanitation workers themselves, mostly middle-aged to older guys who'd been on that job for a long time and went on strike for basic better wages.
Safe working conditions.
Safe working conditions. I mean, just the bare minimum of what you would want from a job, and these men certainly deserved. They went on strike for the basics. And so the African-American community embraced this cause, but it became a flashpoint between Black power and nonviolence. Black power was looking for, in the form of the invaders, was looking for more influence and a greater stake in the civil rights movement in the community by becoming involved with the sanitation strike. And so there was this great tension forming in the community between the invaders and whatever you want to call them, the professional civil rights organizers, the nonviolent civil rights organizers, the establishment, basically the NAACP. It was the old guard versus the young. They both had the same goals, but very different strategy and tactics and talk. And so there was great conflict between them. Well, March 28th rolls around. The strike's been going on for 6 weeks. Dr. King comes. And up until that point, the workers themselves, most of them older guys, would conduct very quiet marches every day from Beale Street, the Beale Street area, up to City Hall, about a mile and a half or so, and back. In one case, there was an outbreak of violence, but otherwise it'd be a couple hundred guys quietly, solemnly doing this march back and forth on a daily basis, as Mayor Loeb, you know, ignored their requests for a modest pay increase and improvements in working conditions and all that. And by the time March 28th rolls around, those protests were what people were accustomed to. But with King coming, 10,000 people showed up, at least. It was as large of a demonstration in the civil rights movement since the Selma to Montgomery marches. I mean, it was massive, and it was pandemonium. It ended up breaking out into violence. The march was supposed to go down Beale Street and then up Main Street to City Hall. It didn't get much further than the corner of Beale and Main because people who were participating in the march, not the sanitation workers themselves, would take the sticks or the posts that protest signs were mounted on, like the famous I Am a Man signs, and smashed store windows, battled with police. And so those sticks were the instruments of a riot. Now, that riot ultimately was blamed on the invaders because the invaders had already been established as the violent ones. I mean, there were rumors about them starting a race riot in Memphis going back to the previous summer. And so naturally, when one finally broke out in Memphis, it had to be the invaders. That was the script. That's what everybody expected. That was the prophecy fulfilled. The truth is a lot more complicated. And I don't know at what point you want to delve into it. Maybe you could tell me a little bit more about what you took away from it that surprised you, that was different.
Well, it was that admission from Withers that he felt some guilt about,
yes,
what had happened,
right,
early on in the book. And then as you see it develop, you understand why he carried that guilt.
Yes, exactly. So hopefully everybody is familiar with the I Am a Man photograph of Ernest Withers. If not, jump online, look it up, check it out. This photograph shows the assembly of sanitation workers out in the street before the beginning of this march. And you'll see that they're carrying their I Am a Man signs on signposts. Throughout the 6 weeks of marches that had taken place before this day, they'd never used sticks to display their signs. It's a weird little oddity, anomaly, that for the first time on this particular march with King leading and all of these tensions simmering in the city, all of a sudden these would-be weapons are distributed in a march and end up being used to break windows and cause tremendous damage to Dr. King.
They were 2x2 boards, which is essentially a 2x4 cut in half lengthwise.
That's right. Yeah, so it would be a 2x4 separated. Sure. Piece of lumber, big hefty piece of lumber. In my research, I was listening to this interview with Withers that had been done in 1981 by a German sociologist. And the sociologist was trying to figure out what was going on in the strike and what led up to the King assassination. And so they were talking about the riot. And Withers said, well, if anybody is responsible for that riot, I might be responsible because I was the one who brought those sticks. And he explained how he got the lumber and rented a skill saw and sawed up the lumber and nailed those signs to the sticks. And, you know, it was a reasonably innocent admission at that time that he felt badly about because of the way things had gone with those sticks becoming the weapons. Well, nobody knew at that time about his FBI affiliation. And so I started wondering, is there some kind of a connection there? And started looking further into the issue of those posts and Withers' involvement, and discovered a bunch of irregularities in the FBI documents pertaining to the invaders, those sticks, and the riot. In the FBI version of events that of that particular event that emerged immediately afterwards, that's in their official documents and records about that riot, they have an informant report supposedly generated by Withers, in which one of the invaders named John B. Smith passes out those sticks without the signs on them to a bunch of young guys and says, "Don't be afraid to use these." That's how the riot was pinned on the invaders. Well, that particular incident also caught the attention of the House Select Committee on Assassinations that looked into the King assassination back in 1978. So they researched the same thing. They interviewed Withers, who they knew had been a confidential informant. They interviewed Lawrence, Agent Lawrence from the local FBI, who was Withers' operative. They interviewed the invaders. They interviewed a man by the name of Morrell McCullough, who was a Memphis Police Department officer who was deep cover, had joined the invaders. He said, "No, I was with John B. Smith during the march," and he never said that. He wasn't near the posts. He didn't distribute them. He didn't hand them out or tell anybody to go break windows or anything like that. Withers, who supposedly had supplied that information to Agent Lawrence, which led to blaming the invaders for the destruction of this march and everything that had happened with it to Dr. King, Withers contradicted the FBI report that he had supplied the information for. And so what it ends up looking like, here I had gotten into it rather frightened that maybe Withers had caused this damage to this march that was so significant in Dr. King's story and that led directly to his assassination. It looks to me like an FBI cover-up of same.
That's a pretty strong insinuation you got there.
It looks to me. You know, that's all I can say is I studied that issue thoroughly with that specific question in mind, and that's where the evidence takes me. And I present the evidence in the book. And, you know, the whole book is presented to let people decide because Withers, on that day, he takes the I Am a Man photo. In the riot, he's out there documenting incidents of police brutality that were published in the Tri-State Defender. To me, it's the crux of this mystery. I mean, is he this journalist who is trying to put together a photo op that can tell the story of the sanitation strike? I Am a Man. That's what that photo does. It tells the story of the strike eloquently. Or is he this guy who's bringing the clubs to this labor dispute? Which, if you think about it, distributing clubs at a labor dispute, I mean, that would be in the front of the playbook for groups in power. I mean, it's not a new idea or a new occurrence in labor disputes, racial disputes. That sort of thing had happened before. That photograph and that moment is the crux of this mystery. Where was Withers on this? And the book is presented and intended to let people decide. I don't, as I said in the beginning, I'm not fit to judge. I touched his photographs when he told me not to. I disobeyed. I'm disobedient. But I'm very thorough and try to be fair, and I want people to take their time because this is serious stuff. You got a great man's reputation on the line here. And to just say this man who was great also informed for the FBI isn't sufficient. You got to go back to the beginning. And you have to really understand his influences, his evolution, his steps, his missteps. And I put all the evidence there. And you can make your own determination because I can't. I don't know. But it's a hell of a story.
Well, and I would have to think that in dealing with these important subjects and these people's lives and reputations, that you have to walk a pretty narrow and tight line while doing all of this. And as a researcher and as a writer, it must have been exhausting, so difficult to be fair, honest, and represent these massive, important things, not only to Memphis's history, but to America's history.
It's way more pressure than I signed up for or thought I signed up for. It was hard. You know, I had some insomnia over the years because my wheels were turning so fast. There's so much complexity to it. There are so many issues. You know, did this man do this? Did my government do this? Is it okay for me at this point to hurt this man's legacy? Am I going to hurt this person's legacy? Am I okay with hurting this person's legacy? If it's over and done with, Should we just let it lie? I mean, these things really bothered me. And so it was really nice to get it over with. But, you know, I put every tear and drop of blood and sweat that I had in those years into these issues because there is so much riding on it. And the other side of it is, look, what if the FBI set this up against Dr. King? Don't we need to know that? Isn't that sort of a big deal? And that's another thing that I think gets overlooked sometimes in Withers the Informant, and that is, this is really the FBI's responsibility. You know, this is the FBI's surveillance of the movement. This is the FBI's surveillance of Dr. King, their obsession with bringing down black power and disrupting a black messiah and all of the weird stuff that J. Edgar Hoover was devoting the taxpayer dollars and crime-fighting resources at his disposal to. All that story is very disturbing, too, and must be kept, I think, at the fore. Withers never would have informed on the movement if there hadn't been this structure against it, if there hadn't been this systematic racism intertwined in our lives. So, yeah, kind of a lot to deal with.
Now, you moved to Virginia several years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Is Memphis going to continue to be a subject that you write about, or are you going to move on to different avenues?
I don't know for sure. I have a bunch of things that I want to do, and I will always love Memphis and be more moved by Memphis stories than anything else. I mean, it's always going to be my passion. The question is, you know, how many more books can I really squeeze out of this? I could write about it forever. How many more is anybody going to want to publish? that's the harder question. Being outside of Memphis, I think, helps me see it a little bit better. I don't get caught up in the day-to-day. I can clearly focus on the issues that I need to focus on, the things that I'm interested in, and the research that I do. And I don't have to worry about who's running for mayor and what the council's doing and whatever else might be happening to distract me. So being apart from Memphis really helps me hone in on it.
Well, is there anything you can tell us that you are working on right now?
I'm ghostwriting a memoir with Robert Johnson's sister.
Wow.
Yeah, it's amazing. So that is another Memphis story. It takes place here, and that's why I got into it. They were looking for a Memphis person to do it. It's part of the family has been silent for a number of years and has finally decided. Mrs. Anderson, she goes by. She's not a first name person. Mrs. Anderson has decided at the age of 93 to tell her story.
He used to busk in North Memphis, didn't he?
She doesn't know about that. There are several performance places that she will put on the map for people, but she was born in 26. And moved here in 1930. And really her best memories of him, she was 10, 11, and 12 in the last couple of years of his life, you know, when really we know him best as the guy in the pictures and the guy who made the records.
Well, Preston, I want to thank you so much for coming back on Book Talk today, and it's a pleasure as always.
It is all mine, and I hope to be back again someday with something or other. I need to introduce you to Mrs. Anderson. She will call you Mr. Usry.
I'll call her Mrs. Anderson.
Yes, you will.
Thanks so much.
All right.
Preston Lauterbach is the author of Bluff City, The Secret Life of Photographer Ernest Withers, which is published by W.W. Norton. I'm Stephen Usry, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com. Or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111. Or call us at 901-415-2752.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WYPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.